And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on our hour-long membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Republican and Democratic senators vote to restrain the president's powers.
An Oregon senator pushes impeachment reform.
And Portland's mayor wants to hear from you on houselessness this evening.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 13th, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we would like to urge you to become a member. You can call us number 877-500-5266. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations is calling for police accountability reforms. This comes after the city of West Lynn agreed to pay a $600,000 settlement to a black man. The Portland man says officers unjustly targeted and wrongfully arrested him as a favor to the West Lynn police chief's fishing buddy. CARE Oregon is also calling for the U.S. Department of Justice to investigate. One of the officers involved now works for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, which the governor oversees. CARE Oregon spokesman Zachar Khan says, quote, "Marginalized communities have waited too long for meaningful reforms of law enforcement to come to Oregon. This alleged misconduct is the result of a lack of proper accountability mechanisms. The governor must immediately develop a police accountability task force to address these problems in policing."
Tonight at 6:30, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler is holding a community conversation on houselessness. Wheeler's inviting people to discuss how the city's addressing housing instability. He also wants them to share their priorities for improvements and budget decisions. The talk is underway at Beaumont Middle School on Northeast Fremont Street in Portland. You can find out more at www.portlandonline.com.
U.S. Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley joined Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen today to introduce new legislation that would require the Senate to consider evidence and hear from witnesses in future impeachment trials. This follows the end of the first ever Senate impeachment trial that did not include any witness testimony. The Merkley-Van Hollen resolution would ensure the rights of both sides to call witnesses and introduce evidence in impeachment trials. Merkley announced his intention to introduce the legislation last week after the Senate voted down motions to subpoena witnesses on near party line votes.
The House managers proved their case that President Trump used our country's vast power in an attempt to smear a political opponent and corrupt the integrity of our upcoming national election. These acts are not merely inappropriate, like lying to the public, shunning allies, or pressing foreign governments to patronize your properties. No, what President Trump did in this case was to direct a corrupt conspiracy that comprised a fundamental assault on our Constitution. It fell to the Senate to hold the president accountable by holding a full and fair trial to uncover the truth and then render impartial justice. Instead, the Senate proved itself neither sufficiently dignified or sufficiently independent, in the words of Alexander Hamilton. Instead, the Senate majority engaged in a cover-up. No witnesses, no documents, no full and fair trial, and so no exoneration. And the Senate's abdication of its responsibility to rein in an out-of-control president is a devastating blow to the norms and institutions and the checks and balances that have laid at the heart of our Constitution and American democracy since its very founding. Yet we must remember that this outcome does not come in a vacuum. It's just the latest in a list of examples of our government being systematically rigged for the benefit of the powerful and the privileged. Decisions in the Supreme Court, like Citizens United, Shelby County, Rucho versus Common Cause, have repeatedly given more power to the powerful and trampled government of, by, and for the people. And efforts like stealing a Supreme Court seat in 2016 and refusing to allow amendments to legislation have only served to erode the Senate's constitutional powers and authority. The Senate majority's refusal to hold a full and fair trial, its blessing to the president to use the powers of government to attack a political opponent, and its decision to cover it all up are a blow to the heart of separation of powers enshrined in our Constitution. They are a blow to the very idea that we, the people, are in charge. Government of the people, by the people, and for the people is not a birthright. It is a precious gift bequeathed to us by those who came before us. It will take the goodwill and good faith of the American people to maintain it. I believe in our Constitution. I believe in checks and balances. I believe in we the people. If we are going to leave that vision to future generations of Americans, all of us are going to have to fight like hell to restore and defend it.
That was Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley. Senator Van Hollen, the other sponsor of the impeachment reform, called the impeachment trial a sham, a disgrace to Congress and the country.
And senators on both sides voted to restrain President Trump's war powers today. The Senate passed an Iran war powers resolution, even though Trump opposes it. It aims to rein in his ability to use military action against Iran without congressional approval. The vote was 55 to 45. 8 Republicans voted in favor of it. The president warned the Senate not to greenlight the measure, tweeting, quote, "If my hands were tied, Iran would have a field day." The White House threatens a veto.
After a jury found longtime Trump advisor Roger Stone guilty on 7 charges of obstruction of justice, lying to Congress, and witness tampering, prosecutors recommended a sentence of 7 to 9 years in prison. President Trump calls the sentence a horrible and unfair miscarriage of justice, hinting at a possible pardon. Following this, the Justice Department changed its recommendation for sentencing. It now urges the judge in the case, Amy Berman Jackson, to take into consideration Stone's age, health, personal circumstances, and lack of criminal history when deciding on a sentence. This change has caused the lead prosecutor, Aaron Zelensky, to resign from the case and return to his former job with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Maryland. Jonathan Kravis, who was the second prosecutor in the case, also resigned from both the case and as a U.S. assistant attorney. The other two lawyers on the case, Adam Jed and Michael Mirando, also withdrew but plan to stay with the Justice Department. A new survey shows 1 in 5 Washington State families cut costs elsewhere in order to afford insulin. KBOO's Yasmin Kobanoglu has more.
A new survey shows the rising cost of prescription drugs is causing mountains of stress for many Washington State families. In particular, skyrocketing insulin prices are causing families to make tough decisions, according to the AARP Washington survey. 1 in 5 families says it has to make adjustments to accommodate costs, such as cutting back on food or electricity, taking less medicine than prescribed, or even skipping a dose. Tina Gozin is a mother of 3 children with diabetes. She says she's fortunate not to be in the tough position of many families. But even with her insurance covering 80% of the cost, the bill is high.
Just the insulin alone, you know, costs roughly $6,000 a year for us just to keep the kids alive with the insulin.
Gozin supports bills in the Washington State Legislature to cap out-of-pocket insulin costs at $100 per month and create a centralized purchasing process for the drug. The AARP survey shows strong support for these approaches, with 93% of respondents agreeing with capping costs and 83% supporting the state negotiating prices. Gozin says the United States should be able to follow other countries where people pay far less to pharmaceutical companies for drugs such as insulin.
A lot of people in the United States can't pay it. Just because some of us can doesn't mean that we should have to, just because it's a way for them to line their pockets and basically hold us hostage, because my kids can't live without it.
The AARP survey finds people also support price controls on prescription drugs beyond insulin. Some 80% strongly or somewhat support out-of-pocket cost caps. 87% believe drug companies should be required to disclose how prices are set, and 91% say it should be easier for generic drugs to come to the market. This is KBOO reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu in collaboration with Eric Tegedoff of the Public News Service.
Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden spoke out today against the Trump administration's budget plan for Medicaid. He says it's really just a way to make cuts that will hurt the young and old alike, calling it bad policy that hurts people.
I'm going to take just a minute and talk about what Medicaid really means for the American people. Medicaid pays for 2 out of 3 nursing home beds in this country. That's because growing older in America costs a lot of money. Before I was elected to Congress, I was the co-director of the Oregon Gray Panthers, Organization for the Elderly. I spent a lot of time visiting with seniors in their homes, and the majority of them were folks who had to stretch every last penny to get by. So this is an issue I take very personally. And even when our people do everything right, when they scrimp and they save over decades, when they give up vacations, they didn't buy a boat, they lived modestly, they do everything they can to prepare for retirement, people run out of money when they get older. All it takes is one surprise illness or injury for the bills to start stacking up, or a family emergency, or damage to a home, your savings dry up. That's the way real life is. And that's on top of those who don't have savings, the millions who couldn't save just because they had to walk an economic tightrope, and half of our people struggle to keep up with $400 if they had an emergency. That doesn't mean that they have no right to see a doctor or get long-term care. Protecting those people is what Medicaid guarantees, and that's what it is. It's a guarantee, and it's what Medicaid's all about. Without it, where do seniors turn when their savings dry up? How are low-income seniors who want to stay in their homes going to afford their health care? So when you hear all this talk, colleagues, about flexibility, innovative solutions, holding the states accountable, in my view, it's code for big Medicaid cuts. The consequences are dangerous, and they are personal. A couple of other points. The Trump administration has gone to court to have the entire Affordable Care Act thrown out. Protections for pre-existing conditions, gone. Tax credits for health care, gone. Rules banning the worst insurance company abuses, gone. Millions of people kicked off their health care. And it would just be devastating for young people like Jasper. He's a little guy, but he's got a really big heart. And he was born with serious medical issues. Jasper, one of my constituents, cardiac and pancreatic problems, hearing loss, gets a lot of costly treatment. And for his family, he and his family, the Affordable Care Act is a lifeline to the peace of mind they absolutely consider vital. Donald Trump has no backup plan for Jasper and his family if he successfully repeals the Affordable Care Act. That didn't stop the president from saying during his State of the Union address that he had made an ironclad pledge to always protect seniors with pre-existing conditions. Donald Trump protects pre-existing conditions like sea lions protect salmon on our mighty Columbia River. It's the kind of protection that comes with an uptick in the mortality rate.
And Senator Wyden also says the president has not followed through on his promise to reduce prescription drug prices. He says drug prices so far are up again this year.
A new bike and pedestrian bridge is in the works in southeast Portland. It'll be near the Orange Line's Clinton Street and 12th Avenue MAX station. TriMet says the idea is to allow people and cyclists to make safe crossings between the Hosford, Abernethy, and Brooklyn neighborhoods. A few weeks ago, TriMet put in the first tower. Today, crews installed the overcrossing's main span. TriMet spokesperson Tyler Graff says, quote, "The previous bridges that spanned the Dune Pacific Railroad tracks were old and rickety." He says the new bridge will be ADA compliant and have elevators on both sides. Crews will install the final tower tomorrow. TriMet expects the project to cost about $10.5 million. They're using Portland-Milwaukee Light Rail Transit Project funds for the new bridge.
And the city of Portland is creating a brand new district beginning this May. South Portland will be the city's first new district in almost 90 years. This new district will run between the Willamette River and NATO Parkway running west and the Portland waterfront to Lewis and Clark College. On May 1st, the addresses of about 10,000 homes and businesses in this new district will change. The city says it's going to cost about $300,000 to change all of those signs in the area that currently say Southwest Portland. The city says it'll take about 5 years to update all of those signs to reflect the new district. City commissioners approved the proposal for a South Portland district back in 2018. The city council hopes the changes will clear up confusion over street address numbers on east to west streets, which have a zero in front of them. Dylan Rivera, spokesperson for the Portland Bureau of Transportation, says, quote, "This is a one-time, relatively minor inconvenience that will pay dividends for the community and the city in the long run." A nonprofit group in Washington state is urging lawmakers to stop focusing on transportation mega projects and start thinking locally. KBOO's Melissa Hood has more on the story.
Instead of expanding highways, one group says that Washington state leaders should focus on local challenges to transportation. Feet First, an Evergreen State group that promotes walkable communities, says while the state has added interstate highway lanes, local maintenance has been neglected. The neglect could make communities more dangerous. In the past decade, pedestrian deaths in the state have doubled. John Stewart, vice president of the board of Feet First, says Washington State's priorities have changed in the past few decades.
Progressive sets of state transportation packages have focused very much on very large projects and have forgotten about the small things. And the small things are what make communities work in the end.
Feet First is urging the governor and lawmakers to measure mobility in forms beyond cars, including walking, biking, and using a wheelchair. It also wants leaders to focus on safety over speed, use funds for maintenance rather than road expansion, and provide equity in spending across the state. Stewart says Feet First doesn't expect big transit changes during this year's short legislative session, but believes some fixes could be on the table next year. The group is one of the nominating agencies for the Transportation Improvement Board, which picks local projects across the state to fund. Stewart says his group gets about 3 times as many applications as it can support and would like to see the state prioritize this program.
That's all about communities trying to figure out how to build more walkable places with the resources they have and looking to the state for help. So thinking about models like that, how do you take the state's transportation dollars and invest them better around the state for the things that matter?
Stewart says the passage of Initiative 976, limiting car registration fees to $30, has removed a crucial funding source for local communities. However, Feet First maintains the initiative gives the state an opportunity to reconsider its priorities when it comes to transportation. For KBOO Evening News and Public News Service, I'm Melissa Hood.
Portland Parks and Recreation is presenting the 4th annual Portlanders Stand with Refugees and Immigrants celebration on Thursday, March 19th. It'll be from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Southwest Community Center on Southwest 45th Avenue. All are welcome to the multicultural gathering to celebrate and welcome people new to Portland and the U.S. Admission is free for music and dancing. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler and other special guests will be there. Event partners include the Refugee Volunteer Organization, the Arabic House, the Kenya Community, and the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland. The event's hashtag #WeStandTogether poster is available in English and 14 other languages. Happy 161st birthday, Oregon. Tomorrow marks the date that Oregon became the United States' 33rd state. And to celebrate, you can go and listen to the Oregon Old Time Fiddlers. And there they are playing. The Oregon Old Time Fiddlers will be playing tomorrow at the Oregon Historical Society starting at 11:30 a.m. till 1 p.m. You can join them for one of the Society's most memorable days of the year, Oregon Statehood Day. Now, in addition to the music, the festivities include birthday cake and remarks from special guests, including former Governor Barbara Roberts. It's a free celebration, and it's open to the public.
You are listening to an hour-long membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can call to renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by calling 877-500-5266. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6, and at 7 it is going to be Hard Knock Radio. The weather tonight will be mostly cloudy with rain down to the low 40s. Tomorrow, we're looking at cloudy skies and a high of 49. Today in history, on this date in 1949, a mob burned a radio station in Ecuador after the broadcast of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. The quote of the day is from former Oregon Governor Barbara Roberts' inaugural address. Quote, "I honor the memory of those brave settlers of Oregon and pay tribute as well to the Native Americans already inhabiting this land before pioneers like my great-great-grandparents arrived here in the mid-1800s. Such dreams of those pioneers had for this territory, some instinct drew them here, a fate pulling, a desire for a deep and lasting change in their lives."
Today, the House voted to remove the 1982 deadline for ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment. This could pave the way for the amendment to finally become law. The amendment states, quote, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." It was first proposed in Congress in 1923 and reintroduced every year until it passed in 1972. The first ratification deadline for the states was 1979. It was extended to 1982 after 35 states ratified it. Nevada's legislature endorsed the ERA in 2017, then Illinois followed suit in 2018. However, five states that ratified the amendment in the 1970s have said they want to rescind it. They are Kentucky, Nebraska, Tennessee, South Dakota, and Idaho. During House debate, Democrats focused mainly on equal rights and how the amendment could positively affect the economy. Republicans argued that the proposed amendment is unconstitutional and stressed the negative effect it could have on anti-abortion laws. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg says she supports the idea of an equal rights amendment, but believes that the current one should be scrapped and a new one written from scratch. The Los Angeles District Attorney has announced the dismissal of 66,000 marijuana convictions. DA Jackie Lacey said today that this is a step in undoing decades of drug enforcement that disproportionately affected people of color. The DA filed a motion this week asking a judge to dismiss thousands of felony and misdemeanor convictions dating back to 1961 in 10 cities across the county. A judge signed it on Tuesday. Because of this, 22,000 people in California will no longer have felonies on their records. 15,000 will no longer have criminal records at all. 45% are Latinx, 32% are Black, and 20% are white. Studies show people of color are more likely to be arrested and punished for marijuana offenses, even though whites, Blacks, and Latinx people all use and sell marijuana at similar rates. Now, before this announcement, people had to petition the court on their own because the process was difficult and time-consuming. Not very many people tried.
In Washington state, tribal leaders prepare their communities for Census 2020, and a Native group files a class action lawsuit against the Canadian government. For those stories, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
South Dakota's refurbished riot legislation passed a House committee Wednesday. The bill rewrites last year's riot-boosting law designed to squelch pipeline protests. Victoria Wicks reports.
Two lawyers from Governor Kristi Noem's office testified in favor of the legislation. One of them is Katie Hruska, who helped draft last year's law that was held by a federal judge to be largely unconstitutional. Hruska tells legislators that this redraft still includes penalties for those who incite crime, but also protects rights of free speech and peaceful assembly.
This is about protecting people and their property and keeping them safe in the very narrowest sense as necessary.
Opponents included representatives of tribes. One of them was Remy Bald Eagle, speaking on behalf of the Cheyenne River Sioux. Bald Eagle tells the committee that the tribe does not support riot, but it does support protests against pipelines, such as the Keystone XL, through treaty-protected land.
Existing criminal laws are adequate to protect us all from individuals who might engage in acts of violence. But who and what will be there to protect us from the devastating consequences of a major oil spill or leak?
One of the opponents was committee member and Speaker of the House, Stephen Haugard. He said if passed, the bill would clean up old riot laws that had been on the books for decades. But he said the penalties are too high and the number of people constituting a riot is too low. I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Preparing for the census is a top priority among tribal leaders gathered in Washington, D.C. this week. Von Golden tells us more.
In her State of the Indian Nations address earlier this week, National Congress of American Indians President Fawn Sharp stressed the importance of this year's count.
Indian country's standard of accountability for the United States government requires a full count of Native people in this year's census, no matter where they live and how they choose to participate.
Matthew Tamaskin is the legislative liaison for the Yakima Nation in Washington.
I'm wanting to make sure everybody's counted.
While he's pushing for those census initiatives, he's also looking at what comes next, the redrawing of congressional districts. He says last time, tribes really had no say in how the districts were drawn, and the two largest reservations in Washington were both split.
There were no people of color on a commission or on a commission staff, so that's what we're trying to make sure we fix this time around.
Census initiatives start in earnest in March. Von Golden, National Native News.
The Assembly of First Nations has filed a $10 billion class action lawsuit against the Canadian government. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
The AFN says through what it calls discriminatory funding, the government created an incentive to remove First Nations nation's children from their families. It also alleges that Ottawa failed to take into account the different needs of First Nations communities across Canada, and that funding for children on reserve was far short of what was allotted to children off reserve. The class action lawsuit goes further than the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal ruling of 2016. It found that the government systemically discriminated against First Nations children on reserve. But the national chief of the AFN, Perry Bellegarde, says the lawsuit covers a much broader group of children from 1991 to 2005 who were not included in the Human Rights Tribunal ruling.
You cannot leave these children out. They're not eligible in that CHRT ruling. So we said we better develop a class action suit here for those children that are affected from that time period. And there's thousands of them. They suffered abuse.
In Ottawa, the Indigenous Services Minister agrees that First Nations children who were harmed by government child welfare policies must be compensated. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
China has reported a massive increase in the number of its citizens infected by the new coronavirus, which scientists have named COVID-19. This comes after they changed how they define the cases to include people who are less seriously ill. Until now, only infections confirmed by a specialized testing kit were considered accurate. However, those kits are now in short supply, so many sick people have gone untested. Now China has started counting patients after doctors screen and identify the illness instead of the testing kits. Overnight, the number of cases increases by almost 15,000. The total number infected is more than 50,000 so far. On Wednesday alone, 254 people died from the disease. China altered how cases are defined after a request from the World Health Organization. The change in the ratio of cases to death suggests that the virus is less deadly than previously feared. The new numbers come just a day after China reported that new infections had hit the lowest point in a single day since the end of January.
Scientists have registered the Antarctic's highest temperature on record. On February 9th, Brazilian scientists on Seymour Island logged a temperature of 20.75 degrees Celsius. That's about 69 degrees Fahrenheit. It's almost a degree higher than the previous record from 1982. On February 6th, an Argentinian research station at Esperanza also measured the highest reading on the continental Antarctic Peninsula at 18.3 degrees Celsius. Scientists confirmed that the peninsula and nearby islands have warmed by almost 3 degrees since the pre-industrial era, which was one of the fastest rates on the planet. Brazilian scientists say shifts in ocean currents and El Niño events seem to influence the rise in temperatures. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced today that this last January was the hottest in recorded history for the entire planet. According to NOAA, it was the 421st consecutive month with temperatures above the 20th century average. The four warmest Januaries on record have all happened since 2016. Scientists predict the warming will continue to accelerate depending on human efforts to reduce emissions.
In today's edition of 2020 Talks, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick dropped out of the race for the Democratic nomination for president. Iowa Democratic Party Chair Troy Price resigned after chaotic results releases in Iowa, and turnout in New Hampshire reached record high levels, but the youth vote wasn't as high as some experts expected.
I want y'all to think of a number, 99.9%. That's the percentage of African American voters who have not yet had a chance to vote in America. One more number, 99.8. That's the percent of Latino voters who haven't had a chance to vote.
Former Vice President Joe Biden kickstarted a push in South Carolina before New Hampshire's votes were counted. He finished fifth in the small majority white state, but he's polling around twice as well as any other candidate with South Carolina's majority black Democratic electorate. The first Southern primary is 2 weeks from Saturday, 1 week after Nevada's. Former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg isn't on the ballot in Nevada or South Carolina. He's trying to get ahead of criticism about an edited 2015 video that came out with statements he made while mayor about young men of color. It rekindled anger about the controversial stop and frisk policy he implemented, considered to be racial profiling. Yesterday, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick exited the race for the Democratic nomination, and Iowa Democratic Party Chair Troy Price resigned in the wake of the caucus reporting chaos to help the IDP move forward with an independent review of the collaborative process between the Iowa Party, its vendors, and the Democratic National Committee. Price said his employees were amazing and didn't deserve the, quote, enduring threats to personal safety, taunts, and anger from people around the globe, unquote. Turnout at the Iowa caucuses was around the same as it was in 2016, but way less than in 2008. A surprise to Laura Bellin, editor of Iowa political website Bleeding Heartland.
I've seen people say, well, you know, there are so many candidates and a lot of people couldn't decide, so they stayed home. Well, New Hampshire had pretty high turnout. New Hampshire's turnout was more like on 2008 level. So I don't think that is really a satisfactory explanation.
Overall turnout was high in New Hampshire. It turned out to be above 2008's record. Arni Arneson, the first woman nominated by the Democratic Party to run for governor in her state of New Hampshire and Pacifica radio host, points out that the youth vote wasn't quite as high as some had expected.
We keep hoping that young people will be engaged and they will vote. It didn't really happen in Iowa, and it doesn't necessarily happen in New Hampshire.
Andrew Feldman from Rock the Vote, a nonprofit that mobilizes young voters, is concerned about a new state law changing the requirements for establishing residency in New Hampshire, which is seen as an attempt to suppress the college vote.
That, you know, can add a lot of confusion and challenges to the process for young people across the state.
Arni Arneson said it's still early to tell whether that new law had a direct impact on potential voters.
But trust me, voter suppression does have an impact because people basically self-select and say, I'm not going to bother. All right? They don't want to go through those hoops. It's hard enough to get people to vote for the first time. It's hard enough to get them to make a decision. And then you create this sort of chaos around what you need to produce. And as a result, then people are going to say, why? What's the point?
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Wolke.
You are listening to an hour-long membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Yasmin Kobanoglu, Melissa Hood, and Eric Tegedoff. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Liam Delta. The evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Annette Newell.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Our in-depth guest today on this special Winter Membership Drive newscast is Melissa Ann Peterson, author of the new novel Vera Violet from Counterpoint Press. Melissa grew up in the logging town of Shelton, Washington, and received her undergrad degree from the Evergreen State College in Olympia and an MS degree from the University of Montana. Over the past 12 years, she's worked in endangered species recovery in both Washington and Montana. Melissa's writing has appeared in Camus, Flyway, Journal of Writing and Environment, and Oregon Quarterly. Vera Violet is her first book. In the words of Toby Vail of the band Bikini Kill, Mel Peterson is the literary voice of the dispossessed Pacific Northwest youth that we've come to know so well through song. Vera Violet is a fantastic debut. Melissa Ann Peterson, thanks for coming into KBOO today.
Thank you for having me.
Melissa, I use that quote from Toby Vail, the drummer for the punk rock group Bikini Kill, in the intro because your book has some of that sensibility and musicality to it. Bikini Kill got started at Evergreen State College in the early 1990s. Were you there around that time? Was that your...
I was not. I graduated high school in the year 2000. But I did meet Toby Vail at the Evergreen State College when I was getting my undergraduate degree. We had a feminism class together, and she was one of the people who really encouraged me to continue writing.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, she has always been super positive and helpful and had even read early drafts. So she's... in my acknowledgments as one of the people who definitely encouraged me and also showed me how to do it once she kind of gave me that initial encouragement. She's showed me how to actually implement the process. So,
now, to give listeners a taste of that book's lyricism and that musical influence, I wonder if you could read one short passage that I just loved.
Yeah, absolutely. My father was so good-looking, he induced certain sounds in a viewer. His sideburns boasted reverb. His crooked smile was outlaw country music. The calluses on his palms made them rough-hewn lumber that boomed and thudded. His arms were heavy and powerful, like Les Paul guitars.
Thank you. I love that passage. And the Les Paul guitar actually plays a bigger part in the rest of the book.
It does. Yeah, that's true.
Now, the grunge music scene started in that area of Washington State around the same time as Bikini Kill, not your tenure at Evergreen State. Kurt Cobain grew up in Aberdeen and formed Nirvana in the late 80s. In Vera Violet, you connect grunge to its birthplace, and I'll read this quote from the book. We knew that grunge was the sound of a screaming saw blade, a spawning salmon flicking gravel. It looked like a clear cut, and if you cracked grunge open, you would find a moldy fifth wheel trailer inside. Now, Vera's hometown in the book is David, Washington, which is a fictionalized Shelton, Washington, your hometown. What was your own experience growing up in Shelton? Was it that clear cut, the moldy fifth wheel trailer, the salmon, the saw blades?
Yeah, so growing up during that time, there was definitely a lot of logging. So I do remember just driving through miles and miles of clear cuts. And I think when I was younger, we all have the tendency to kind of normalize our situations. And so in my mind, that was how things were. Trees were cut down. And it was kind of interesting regarding salmon, because I do remember salmon runs being much different when I was younger, going out fishing with my family. And I even remember the salmon runs decreasing by the time I was in high school. And then when I was in my 20s and was working in the fields, it was kind of to the point where there were a lot fewer fish. And that's when there were a lot more regulations being put in place.
And the actual kind of milieu of the town, it was kind of lower middle class, would you say? Or I mean, the teens in Vera Violet are living a very almost desperate lower middle class existence in this fictionalized Shelton.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's definitely a working class town. Back then, it wasn't as much of a bedroom community as it is now. Right now, a lot of people are kind of pushing out from Olympia, even Tacoma area, and buying houses there because it's more affordable. And so in that way, the demographic of the town has changed quite a bit. But when I was younger, it wasn't as much like that. It was very much manufacturing timber town.
Now, in the book, we mentioned Vera and her friends are teens, and they're fighting, sometimes literally, she considers herself a fighter, for a better life amid the town's depressed economy, meth heads, neo-Nazis, teenage pregnancies. One thing that struck me was how you contrast this life in a small, depressed, and often depressing town because of the rain, the gloom, and the economy in the Pacific Northwest with the great beauty of the region. That was something you consciously did. And I mean, you mentioned a lot of real places like the Hamahama River, Winooch Lake, Solduck River, and the Olympic National Forest.
Yep, it's definitely the good and the bad. I think it's one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. And one of the things that I love about living so close to the Olympic Peninsula is it really does have everything. You can go to the saltwater. You can go to the Olympic National Park and see huge old growth trees, and it's a popular vacation destination, and in the summertime especially is filled with tourists and all of these people who just come to see this beautiful environment. But also there is the dark side. There are the people who have been abandoned economically and are struggling. And that exists too. So I think what I wanted to do is kind of paint a realistic picture of the entire scope of what's happening in that area and what was happening in that area.
All this desperation among all this beauty. Yeah. And what was interesting to me also when Vera Violet, she's 18 years old. Well, the book kind of goes back and forth in time. Mm-hmm. She leaves her hometown at that age in Washington State, and she gets a job at a grade school in St. Louis in a poor urban neighborhood. So it's almost all black students there. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if that was a way for you to kind of connect characters in the same desperate situation by class, despite the racial differences. You're the poor white, the poor black.
Yeah, I think what I wanted to do is kind of show that poverty is interrelated and that economic problems are nationwide. And I believe that collaboration is going to be at the heart of any kind of widespread economic change that we want to make in the country. And so I think mostly my reason for doing that was to just show that these problems affect all of us at different levels. So all of the information that we're getting in the book is through, like you were saying, through the lens of this teenage girl. And so there's a lot of points in the book where it just kind of shows that poverty is kind of what hurts you physically, but poverty is also what can hurt your soul. Like the isolation of poverty is more what hurts your soul. And it's the poverty itself that can damage your body. And so there's a lot of points in the book where she's feeling lonely because she's separated from her family and separated from her friends. And she's also really struggling to reach out too, and there's all these kind of halfway formed ideas in her head, but she's also a teenager from a small town with this really limited scope. And so there's a lot of points in the book where I'm just kind of trying to highlight that isolation, that feeling of isolation, and the way that poverty isolates people from things that other people might take for granted in society.
So. And I think you do that extremely successfully in the book. It's very moving.
Thank you.
A very moving story. Melissa, we should mention that you'll be reading from Vera Violet at Powell's, the downtown location, at 7:30 tonight. Where can listeners find out more about your upcoming events and your work?
They can find information on my website, melissaannpeterson.com. I have a full tour schedule there, as well as links to past writing if people are interested in that. And it can also, I do have a Facebook page for an author account, and there's also a Facebook page for the book too. So
and the book goes on sale. It's already on sale, right?
Yeah,
I have an advanced copy, so I wasn't quite sure. Yeah. So people will be able to buy Vera Violet wherever good books are sold.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Well, Melissa, thanks so much for coming into KBOO, especially just before your Powell's reading this evening.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking with Melissa Ann Peterson, author of the new novel, Vera Violet, from Counterpoint Press. Melissa will be reading and signing books tonight at Powell's in downtown Portland at 7:30 p.m. You can find out more on her website, melissaannpeterson.com. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News In Depth.